You're listening to America's Most Challenging Issue, where Baha'iTeachings.org interviews community builders across the nation who are inspired by the Baha'i vision of the oneness of humankind. Join us as we explore their work, bringing about racial unity and establishing a more just and equitable society. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. Baha'i writings say that a child is like a young plant. It will grow in whatever way you train it. My guest today, Homa Tavangar, believes that a thoughtful, intentional approach to education, predicated on equity and inclusiveness, can raise children who see themselves as members of a diverse, expressive, global community based on meaningful relationships and reverence for the human spirit. A scholar, educator, writer, advisor to diverse organizations, and public speaker, Homa, together with Eric Dozier, founded the Oneness Lab, where they have innovated an educational model that goes deeper than diversity through five elements of relationship building: frequency, proximity, reciprocity, knowledge, and imagination. In her best-selling book, Growing Up Global, Raising Children to Be at Home in the World, she offers parents a toolbox of fun activities, conversation starters, geographical awareness, and diverse cultural traditions that can help to cultivate a global literacy within our youth. She is series consultant for NBC's animated children's program, Nina's World, starring Rita Moreno and Mandy Patinkin, which is based in part on Growing Up Global, and an advisor to Disney Channel and Empatico.org, an initiative focused on deepening empathy by connecting classrooms around the world. Homa's latest project is Global Kids, a deck of 50 cards with activities from around the world intended to open minds and hearts while kids have fun. She serves on the board of the Tahrir Justice Center, assisting immigrant women and girls fleeing violence, and on the board of International School Services, the largest provider of support to international schools around the world. And in addition to her diverse service-oriented work, she is a wife and mother of three daughters. Homa Tavangar, welcome to America's Most Challenging Issue.
Thank you so much, Masoud. I'm really so happy to talk to you.
You know, as I was researching you, it was clear and evident to me that you have, you know, this passionate commitment for developing modalities that combat racism and xenophobia through education, right? It has been said that racism is not a birth defect, but rather a learned pattern of behavior. Now, you have worked in a number of spaces, conducting workshops as a consultant, as a writer, and as co-founder of the Oneness Lab. Now, these various iterations of your practice are all focused on building a more interconnected world by developing what you call our global literacy. I love that term. Can you unpack that term for me and also share what led you to this work?
Sure. It is loaded. So words like global literacy are connected to ideas like global competence, global citizenship, sort of global anything, which recently has gotten a pretty bad rap. And I think part of that is a lack of understanding of what these really mean. So as a Baha'i and as somebody who grew up in a Baha'i home, but from many different religious paths that led us here, it was very natural for me to grow up with an idea of imagining what the oneness of humanity means. So for me personally, from a young age, I began to gain that, you can call it literacy. But most people are not growing up with that. In fact, I think more than ever, there's a sort of us against them mentality. So in my work, one element that I work on training teachers has to do with global competence. Global competence sort of officially or academically is thought of as the knowledge, skills, and dispositions necessary to navigate and succeed in today's interconnected world. And that in itself is sort of a mouthful. It has to do with learning skills of how to investigate the world through just eyes and a wider perspective, how to recognize different perspectives, how to take action and communicate ideas in ways that are informed by a wider knowledge of the world. But the most simple entry point for building global literacy and global competence that I talk about, that has really been sort of an aha moment for me and informed by the Baha'i writings, is the definition that I use for global citizenship. And I think of a global citizen as being a friend to the whole human race. And that has been a really profound idea for me. It comes out of not even a full sentence in the Baha'i writings. It's like half a sentence from Abdu'l-Bahá that I feel like over the past decade, I'm literally building my career on being a friend to the whole human race. And it's asking parents, educators, executives, anyone willing to listen, and kids to consider what are the elements of being a good friend. And that is such a universal idea that even if people who feel hostile to quote unquote globalist ideas, they do relate to being a friend. And so when we examine the qualities of loyalty and respect and helping out and they got your back and solving problems together and not judging and having fun, this helps us realize that actually I have room in my heart to be friends with more than one person. It's like I can be friends locally, I can be friends globally, I can look at problems that are near me and expand my vision to think about the world I inhabit. And as we begin to build those capacities of expanding our vision, we start to build this literacy and, dare I say, love for humanity that takes us beyond, and it really enriches our life. It gets us beyond fear and towards sort of an abundant, loving way of looking at the world. And so that's been actually really an exciting sort of unfolding of my work, and how these terms with global literacy, global citizenship, sort of fit together.
That's wonderful. I like the way that you are essentially distilling what in some sense can be a very academic, like, you know, definition of, you know, this notion of global competency, global literacy, to friendship, right? You know, what is at the core of that global competency, that global literacy? It's building friendships. And I just love that. I love the way that you describe that.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And it's intimate and personal. That's what it also takes it to, like a friendship. So often it's an academic exercise or it's a materialistic exercise. Like, we want our children to gain global competence because it's going to make them successful in a cutthroat global economy. But what I've talked to parents all over the world and found that actually what makes it stick is when we see it as a moral imperative and not just a materialistic one.
I love that. I love that. Wow. You know, one of the catchphrases that is such a prevalent feature of the way we speak about inclusion is diversity, right? But, you know, in your work with the Oneness Lab, you indicate that diversity is not enough. The principal goal of the Baha'i Faith is to establish a global fellowship predicated on unity and diversity. Do you see a difference in how we commonly think about diversity and how the Baha'i writings define it?
Yes, sort of. I think the way we commonly think of diversity is often kind of part of a checklist. You know, it's like, okay, we have, you know, people from this background and this religion and this sexual orientation. Okay, I can check the box. And what we've found, and what is a very profound idea, is that diversity is not the goal. It is not enough. And one lesson I've learned from my work with Eric Dozier is the idea that the plantation was diverse, but clearly that is not what we're going for. It's not about diverse bodies in the same space. It's looking at the privilege and the power, and ultimately it's relationships, and it goes back to this much deeper idea of oneness. So what we are trying to do is help people examine, it has to do with inclusion and equity. What are the conditions that can allow for true unity, relationship built on, deep respect, reciprocity, all those elements that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I often think that, I've been fortunate to do some work in the public sphere through acting, my engagement with acting. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that, we're in this moment, in this time in entertainment, right, in the entertainment industry, where we're having much more diverse and inclusive conversations. But even as that is happening, what they are finding is that it's so important to have people who are behind the scenes in the decision-making, roles to help not just have, kind of like the appearance of diversity, but diversity writ large into the very fabric of the structure. So I think that's what you're saying. And I totally agree with that. It's really, really profound. Thank you. Yeah, so much of the effort to dismantle racism is focused on building meaningful relationships. Research has shown that when we take the time to listen to each other's story, right, we weaken the barriers that separate us. And the Baha'i World community is engaged in a plan of social action that we call the core activities, which focuses on strengthening neighborhoods through things like children's classes, junior youth empowerment workshops, devotional gatherings, and study of the sacred writings. Yeah, I'm thinking about this, and it seems to me that at the core of these activities are relationships. Now, you have helped to develop a systematic approach to this work. And I'm wondering if you can tell me about the five elements of relationship building and why you think they are so important.
Okay. So I just will say one thing, that in my own life, I'm involved in a local, Baha'is call them a local children's class in our neighborhood. We call it here, we have a cute little name of spiritual education for little global citizens. And it is just my project of my heart. And I have to say the relationship with the really diverse families that have been involved has been just a light every Saturday morning that I get to see in real time. And nothing has brought a group of diverse families together like this working together. Starts out on behalf of our kids, but it is for a much bigger purpose. And so these personal experiences, as well as a lot of research that's out there from neuroscience to what creates things like psychological safety to social research, there's a new study actually Sesame Workshop just did on how to talk to kids, the need to talk to kids about race and difference and how important that is. And lots of other experiences have kind of helped us pinpoint these five elements. And they are five elements to building deeper relationship. And they are, first, frequency. So the frequency of contact. It can't just be a one-off, like, oh, we're going to have a diversity day and then move on. It's a constant iterative effort where even if you fail, even if you said something ridiculous, you're going to see that person again tomorrow or next week, and you get to try again, and you get to say, hey, I realize that was not the brightest thing to say, but you get another chance. So frequency is important. Proximity is important. So being proximate, being close to people who differ from you, and seeing each other in action is crucial. And there are many examples in history between Palestinians and Israelis. There's a school that we studied that these kids are together for 12 years of their education, and they wouldn't dream of being at war with each other because they know each other as real people. Or the way that many white nationalists like Derek Black have totally transformed their outlook on the world from the proximity of relationship and having dinner with people who differ from you, and breaking bread and sharing a meal, for example, can be one of the most powerful things we do to create world peace. And there are so many examples of people whose hearts have been transformed by the simple act of sharing a meal together. And that is very much goes to the idea of Baha'i core activities and community building to bring people together. The next element is looking at knowledge. So in the Baha'i writings, we look at the principle of the independent investigation of the truth, that each person must come to the truth for themselves. And there are a lot of ways to kind of build out this idea that knowledge isn't just gained from like the Western canon of what has been acceptable in academia. And that sort of knowledge has been really harmful. I'm reading a book right now called Stamped from the Beginning, the definitive idea of the definitive history of racist ideas in America by Ibram Kendi, that has been so powerful to me in unraveling the sources of knowledge. Like in the Ivy League, in, you know, our political processes, what we have encountered, you know, in, you know, theories of evolution and theories of genetics that have been so harmful to humanity's realization of oneness, that we really need to re-examine where we get our knowledge from, what we accept as knowledge. And, and when we start to talk about this with, for example, educators, it helps open their mind to teaching their diverse students and thinking about the responsibility they have in building lifelong learners. The fourth element is reciprocity. So a quick way of thinking about that is that, you know, doing social action is not just a charity. It's not just a, you know, something we pity people about, but examining how we grow through reciprocity. This is embodied in call and response music. It's embodied in global citizenship being thought of as being a friend to the whole human race. There are a lot of ways of thinking about diversity through reciprocity, or relationship really is a matter of reciprocity. And then finally, imagination is the fifth element. And so being able to imagine or dream the world we want to build is really powerful, because clearly we're not living in it. And so being able to exercise our imagination muscles, which are often so limited in traditional education, so limited in busy lives, and giving time to daydream, giving time to be creative, imagine the world that might be, is very powerful. So those are that's a quick summary of what those five elements are. And we spend days in workshops helping teams, helping educators think through this, and it actually, like, each time it's different, and it kind of leads to a little bit of magic. And I really think that in a very humble way, Baha'i communities are also striving to realize these ideas in our grassroots community building with humility and respect and love and kindness, really kind of as overarching themes throughout all of these elements.
It's wonderful because, you know, my nature is a visual learner. You know, I learn things visually. And to see you break that down, that process of relationship building into these steps, is really helpful in terms of, you know, being able to kind of just have something that you can go to and make sure, well, am I doing this? Am I doing that? Am I doing that? And all of these are key components to building relationships. I did also want to acknowledge, as you were talking about these different ways of knowing, these kind of cultural literacies, right, that are not just Western. They're also Eastern, they're indigenous. And I was thinking about a wonderful essay called Philosophy of the Sea by a Nigerian scholar, Orobi, who passed away a few years ago. But he talks about how these different literacies came over with the enslaved Africans in the belly of the slave ship. And those literacies were, you know, sonic, gastronomic, body, you know, movement based, linguistic, and also sonic.
Exactly.
And all of those are valid ways of passing on, of retaining knowledge, and giving it to the next generation. So,
exactly.
Imagine
I'm so happy the power that is unleashed when we allow for that sort of all those literacies to be respected and developed. There is power unleashed with that.
You know, Homa, one of the aspects of your work that I love so much is your dedication to the education of children. So we're going to just shift here just a bit, because I really want to get to some of this. You know, and you view that education of children as a key element in the fight against racism. In your writing, you have focused on raising children who think of themselves as what you call global citizens. And we're living in such a divisive time, right? I mean, so much of how we see ourselves and each other seems to be processed through our fears. And now we know that, you know, in the Baha'i writings, children are identified as, quote, the most precious gift a community can possess, for in them are the promise and guarantee of the future. Now, I'm wondering what that phrase means to you and how it impacts your approach to educating children, in particular in regards to the issue of race.
So I think that when we think of children as the most precious gift, another teaching that's really been very valuable to me from the Baha'i writings is the idea that regard each child as a mine rich in gems of inestimable value, and that education is what can bring out those gems. So rather than an approach that a child is an empty bucket waiting to be filled, our responsibility as parents, as educators, is to bring out the gems that already exist. And that is really requires a deep kind of fundamental acknowledgement of the nobility of that child. And so you take ideas like the nobility of the child in the context of the world that we're in right now, and this sort of, you know, earth is but one country, this unavoidable coming together, this globalization train that has already left the station that we cannot turn back, and think about, so what are the ways to bring out those minds in a context of a wide open world? And so that is what this work that I've been doing really for the last little more than a decade has really been sort of striving to realize. So before, I was working on global sort of business development, global market development with adults. And frankly, in a lot of ways, that was number one, it was just to help their business grow, or not just, I mean, that's important too, but it was to help their businesses grow, help keep jobs, help people, you know, have work with dignity. But it also, I found that it was late. You know, people were very set in their ways. And yeah, they might listen to me in order to make the numbers for that quarter, but it isn't like a profound life change. And this idea of educating children as global citizens and educating them as sort of anti-racist children is very vital. And one thing that's happening right now in education is that, people are starting to embrace the idea of the need to educate global citizens. And they see that as a very separate silo from educating for racial literacy, educating for racial activism and anti-racism and love, you know, whatever is the term that encompasses this idea. And so we're, I don't know, we're like so trained to think in a limited and siloed way that we can't see this idea of global citizenship and anti-racism as all really one. And it's not about glossing over difference. It's not about glossing over urgencies, because I think that's another thing that starts to happen. But in fact, teaching parents anti-racist techniques is a vital part of raising global citizens and educating global citizens. So I have a slide in my presentation when I talk to parents, and I have the bounty of talking to parents literally all over the world. I was in Columbus, Ohio last week. I'll be in Washington, D.C. next week. I'll be in Rome the week after. Like, this is a dream to get to do this. And, you know, when I talk to parents, I have this slide that says how to raise racist kids. Step one, don't talk about race. Don't point out skin color. Be colorblind. And then step two, actually, that's it. There is no step two. Congratulations, your children are well on their way to believing that, you know, whatever you are is better than everybody else. And people are like, what are you talking about? I grew up thinking that we should be colorblind and that's being nice. And it's like, no, all this research now shows, and literally I think yesterday Sesame Workshop came out with a new study to reinforce this idea that talking about race, especially with your kids, is not racist. So in fact, avoiding talking about race makes race unspeakable. And so that gives race, or, you know, being aware of race and being a champion and defender of justice, a negative connotation if you don't talk about it. And so most white adults and teens, it's part of a white privilege. They will participate in these conversations about race only when there's a problem. And so we might be inadvertently giving our kids this message: you only talk about it when it's a problem. You don't get out in front of it. You don't celebrate diversity. And so I try in my work, whether it's training teachers or like I have this new product for young children called Global Kids that I will make a little plug. Global Kids are 50 activity cards that expose children to like the breadth of cultures around the world through specific activities that not only through the artwork shows diverse abilities, diverse races, diverse religious faith expressions, lots of different you know, the beauty of diversity. And in the cards, there's an idea that I am inspired by the Baha'i writings that teaches children to think about our world like a beautiful garden. And that that garden is beautiful when it contains a diversity of colors of flowers, sizes of flowers, shapes, fragrances. This garden is wondrous. It inspires awe. It is beautiful. It makes me so happy. And we can start talking to three-year-olds about the beauty of diversity. And then we start to build up, even younger than three, we start to build up the sort of muscle, the capacity of empathy, of action, of being an ally, very, very young, to have the courage to speak out and know that talking about race, talking about diversity is not racist. In fact, it's the exact opposite. And so these simple activities we do with our children, or, you know, like I'm inspired by the TED Talk, Adichie, of the danger of a single story. And so we try to teach that for even young children. So when we have a card in Global Kids about Iraq, for example, I ask, you know, people, what's the first thing you think of when you think of Iraq? And people say, oh, I think of war. And it's like, well, Iraq was also the the place where algebra was invented. So with kids, we're going to learn about Arabic numbers, and we're going to make them with Play-Doh, and we're going to learn how to count to 10 in Arabic. And then we're going to have something sort of positive to latch onto from this great civilization. Or when you think of Rwanda, people think of genocide. But with kids who are a blank slate, we're going to teach them that actually Rwanda is the first place in the world to have a ban on single-use plastic bags. So we're going to make, and they penalize people. That's a longer story. It's a longer history. But for a five-year-old, that's age appropriate. They're going to learn that Rwanda is the first place to ban single-use plastic bags. And like inspired by their innovation, kids will make a penalty pot inspired by the basket, a special art style that was invented in Rwanda, and learn from them in order to cut down on plastic bag use at home. So this is like, it's kind of a silly, you know, like these are just really kind of micro ways, but they help build this knowledge of the oneness of humanity, this knowledge of our world that is not to be feared, but is to be learned about. And I think you asked how I started to get into this. And I basically began to think about this pretty intensely after 9/11. At the time, I had two children, and I was looking for resources that could talk to my own kids about this world that they're inheriting, about how the world is changing, but in a positive way. And I found books on things like how to talk to your child about terrorism. And I didn't want to talk to my child about terrorism. I know, or I believe from the Baha'i writings, that love never dwelleth in a heart possessed by fear. So I don't want their heart to be possessed by fear. I want it to be overpowered by love. And so I began to look for resources that would help in this process. And even I, who had studied these issues, who worked as a consultant advising big companies and small companies, entrepreneurs on global ideas and global markets, I couldn't find those resources. So I had the benefit of really being raised as a global citizen, and I wanted that for my kids. So I basically set out to buy the book I wanted to buy. And that's how Growing Up Global came about. And then I keep, every year I think, oh, well, we must be getting better at this question. And then, you know, I read about the rise of nationalism right now. That is a deep concern. And so what I hope is that these tools like Global Kids, Growing Up Global, but especially things like neighborhood children's classes, they're like an inoculation against this disease of nationalism and racism and division, which are kind of, those are easy cop-outs for a lot of leaders that are not taking that moral high ground. And I see that there is so much power when families take the reins of standing up for what they believe in and doing what's right. And then schools are following, and many educators, there are a lot of incredible educators all over the world who are really committed to these ideas and doing amazing things in their classroom. And they just need a little help, a little support, like where to begin.
So many amazing gems of learning and knowledge in what you've shared. It's wonderful. Thank you. You know, so Homa, we are running out of time, and you know, sometimes you get a hold of a good thing and you don't want to let it go. But you know, in this case, we do have to. But you know, before we go, I wanted to ask you about hope. You know, this is hard work, right? I mean, developing methods that help to build systems of equity and inclusion in a world that is marching steadily towards, you know, kind of disruption and disintegration. Yeah, it's challenging. And I wanted to know what gives you hope. Why commit so much of your creative energy to a task that is so seems so intractable and difficult?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, what I think is interesting is when you look at the picture from a macro scale, when you look at it from like an overwhelming Twitter feed or a 24/7 news cycle, it does not feel very hopeful. But when you break it down and you talk to real people, you know, that idea of relationship, you talk to real people and you see there is a lot of effort out there. People are, the creativity is endless. The fierceness that we want to raise our kids and do the right thing that animates people is an unlimited well. And that is beautiful. It's exciting. And I think it's very real. There's this quote that we use when we open up our Oneness Lab workshop that comes from Abdu'l-Bahá, the son of the founder, Baha'u'lláh. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "Do not be satisfied until each one with whom you are concerned is to you as a member of your family. Regard each one either as a father or as a brother or as a sister or as a mother or as a child. If you can attain to this, your difficulties will vanish. You will know what to do." And that, like, it sounds so simple, but it is so profound. If you think about if your child has a serious problem, there is no limit to the solutions you will look for to solve that problem or to protect them, to help them. And so Abdu'l-Bahá is saying here, don't be satisfied until you truly see the world and you see the members of humanity as your family members. And if you can attain to this, your difficulties will vanish. You will know what to do. And so beginning to engage with people in our own communities is actually like the most global thing you can do. It's the irony of, it's sort of the false dichotomy of the line between global and local. Like, don't draw that line. Get really involved in your neighborhood. Plant a garden in your neighborhood. That might be the most global act you can carry out because it is breaking down boundaries. It's opening your vision, and it's truly, I think it's helping solve, it helps you see intractable problems have solutions. There's a lot to be hopeful for, even in the darkest times.
Thank you so much, Alma. This has been such a gratifying, personally, and I think for the audience at large, such a gratifying conversation. You've been listening to America's Most Challenging Issue. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. And remember, let them never forget the imperative to tend to the needs of the children of the world and offer them lessons that develop their spiritual faculties and lay the foundations of a noble and upright character. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.
Thank you so much for these great questions and this forum.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Alma. Thank you.